Hello there. Today is Monday, September 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, aid workers describe the complete devastation they're witnessing in the Bahamas.
Anything that they need, we're also helping evacuate people off the island, getting them back into Nassau for those people who have no place to live.
Secret talks with the Taliban called off by the Trump administration. Also ahead, NASA remixes an Ariana Grande song to promote its mission to put a woman on the moon. It's all on today's International Edition. Hundreds of troops Sunday helped clear trees from Dorian, which tore through the Atlantic coast overnight in Canada, leaving almost 500,000 people in three provinces without power. Dorian, classified as a strong post-tropical storm, hit Nova Scotia hard after ripping into the Bahamas a week ago as a Category 5 storm with winds and some gusts topping 320 kilometers per hour. It left a trail of death and destruction with 43 confirmed dead, a number that is expected to rise. Officials are pulling bodies still from the wreckage across the islands and acknowledge that the current official death toll will likely rise. Rescue workers on the ground say the scene on Grand Bahama is hard to comprehend, with homes, schools, and hospitals flattened, roads collapsed, and cars and boats hanging in trees.
We don't have no power, no water, and we can't. It's hard to live over here. It's hard to live. We sleep outside. Even outside isn't even cool. No trees to give breeze, nothing at all.
Many residents, Abacos evacuee Pastor Octerville Baptiste, lost everything and see an uncertain future.
We don't know much right now, but our house and everything is collapsed. You know, there's many person in the same situation, but everything will be all right.
Some survivors, like Godfrey Ferguson, imagine that their loved ones may assume they've perished.
Water, food, baby, diapers and wipes, and just all around anything that they need. We're also helping evacuate people off the island, getting them back into Nassau for those people who have no place to live.
The United Nations estimates some 70,000 people are in need of food, clean water, and shelter. Many of them are children, some who have lost their parents. The United Nations Children's Fund has sent 1.5 tons of life-saving humanitarian aid to assist. And joining us to talk more about their relief efforts is UNICEF Regional Emergency Specialist Hanosh Barlevi.
It's very much for water and sanitation equipment identified by the government as the immediate needs. And obviously, we're always looking at water, sanitation, and food as the first response to in any emergency. So in this case, the idea was to give all this stuff immediately, as quickly as possible. And we hope to get this stuff to the Abaco Island very soon. One of the things, we want to avoid additional diseases. And so obviously, that people have water. So it is from jerrycan, from small household jerrycan to big bladders, big tanks, water treatment, and that kind of stuff. So it is to household, community, and also water treatment at the same time.
Have you had a chance to speak with relief people on the ground there who have been able to describe what they are experiencing?
We are also constantly on the ground there also. We are back and forth all the time. Yesterday, we have spent all day in Abaco, and we're also speaking to different other agencies. We are going together as a complementary interagency missions, and also the way we are working, we are very much complementing each other. And other relief that's already on the ground, but also to keep in mind that many people slowly have been evacuated. So this is something that we also have to factor this. While we are supporting children and their families in Abaco, the number is getting smaller, and we also have to look at on the other island where people are going. Few of them are going to their relatives, but few of them don't have relatives or don't have the means to get temporary solutions. So we are working with the government to ensure that children and their families getting the immediate needs for their well-being. People still quite shocked and terrified by the event. The devastation is enormous. Everything is just gone, collapsed. Many houses, many facilities, electricity, everything. Imagine that in a second, a child losing both parents or one of the parents. We found few children that not few, quite few of them, that lost relatives or even their immediate parents. They're still kind of trying to bring the pieces together at this stage. So that's why we're also looking at how to work on how to support psychosocial kind of treatment for children, and mainly children, but also to their parents, to the older community. The people are quite traumatized and left without anything. That's the image that you have to realize, that you are staying in a glimpse of a second without anything. You're home, and in a second, you don't have it.
What about the children? That is UNICEF's, of course, number one focus. Any idea how many children that you are needing to respond to, or is it still too soon and chaotic to really have those kinds of numbers?
Working with the government here, and we know numbers of children in total, and from both islands, we're also looking at Abaco and the Grand Bahama, of around total exposed around 10,000 children. And among them, with their groups that are more vulnerable, and probably we will be able to narrow down. But at the moment, we're looking at 10,000 children that have been exposed to the hurricane, and then from this we will have to start to identify the most vulnerable ones that lost their parents, ones that have lost their house. There are different categories of vulnerability that we are now working with the government to identify and to ensure that we are addressing as much as possible different needs so they can come back to some sort of normality as much as one can say.
Now, after this first huge shipment that UNICEF is sending, do they plan to continue to reassess the needs and continue to provide whatever is needed?
Absolutely. Assessing the situation is quite evolving. And assessment from our perspective, we are doing it on a daily basis to kind of adjusting the needs. We're definitely looking at providing educational equipment, material. Next week, school is supposed to start, and we want to make sure that all children are back to school activities, even in a formal or a non-formal way, but they're all coming to any kind of educational framework. So we are definitely looking at cool material, any kind of recreational material as well, equipment, so children can come to play immediately as the obvious thing that kids want to do. We are going to focus on these two areas, and also the ton and a half that we shipped this week. That's not the end of the story. We are going to assess, and if there's need more for water and sanitation equipment and material, we're going to bring more. It's an ongoing process. It's not one shot, and by this we are stopping. That was the very immediate shipment, and that we are very much looking to bring in according to the needs. And we're working very close with the government, with many other agencies and relief organizations that are on the ground and working around this. We're also helping to coordinate it, so it is also in a bit more effective fashion, the whole response, and really addressing, so we are not creating duplication. At the same time, really addressing all the needs. We're not leaving anyone behind. No children left behind. The assessment done on a daily basis. We are adjusting our plan to support in any possible way, and we'll continue to support as much as we're also bringing equipment and material. We're very much also supporting the technical aspect of this, the coordination, information management. There are other UN agencies. We're all working together. And as we speak, while I came back, there are other colleagues that continue going there, working with the local authorities to still looking at how best bring together services and support to children at all different aspects. We hope we managed to make children happy again. We have a program called Return to Happiness, working on the psychosocial aspect of a child, trying to bring normality as much as possible, given the circumstances in any kind of given situation of emergency.
All right, that's UNICEF Regional Emergency Specialist Hanoch Bar-Levi. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Taliban denounces President Trump's move to call off peace talks and claims the U.S. will return to negotiate. A huge crowd takes Hong Kong protests' message to the U.S. consulate. British politician has resigned over Prime Minister's handling of Brexit, and scientists study whether virtual reality can prevent cognitive decline and dementia. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump has called off Afghanistan peace talks that had been secretly planned for Camp David this weekend. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
We've made enormous progress.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told ABC's This Week the Taliban had made commitments to break with al-Qaeda, begin reconciliation talks with the Afghan government, and reduce violence.
And then the Taliban overreached. They killed an American in an effort to gain leverage at the negotiating table. And President Trump said enough.
But Afghan presidential spokesman Sadiq Siddiqui says,
we didn't see any commitment by the Taliban for any peace process, except talking and then, continuing to kill Afghans and our partners.
The Taliban says it was satisfied with the peace deal, and President Trump's decision to cancel the Camp David talks have hurt U.S. credibility. Ben Thomas, Washington.
In the week since military and civilian leaders in Sudan signed a landmark power-sharing agreement, heavy rains have caused flooding along the Nile, damaging tens of thousands of homes. The pact calls for a three-year transitional period leading to elections for a civilian government. Although the political instability has created extra problems, many victims say the revolution has strengthened their sense of community. In Khartoum, Esha Sarai and Naba Mohideen have more.
As political negotiations continue in Khartoum on the formation of a new government, thousands of houses remain underwater.
That is my house. The water reached to this level. Every part inside the house is full of water. The house is full of water, more than mine, and there's also two houses. We're collapsed.
Fuel shortages, one of the causes for months of anti-government protests that toppled President Omar al-Bashir, have increased the challenge of draining flooded areas, as most pumps require fuel. With the political transition in progress, local aid organizations such as NAFIR are not sure of how and when state aid will become available.
Sadly, this happens every year, and that this is a problem of infrastructure, city planning, and sanitation. Government intervention is still very slow, and that political turmoil has already affected the process, as no government has been formed yet. That also changes the situation.
NAFIR, which means collective or community aid, comprises volunteers who assess damages, collect water and medicine, and sometimes help evacuate victims from affected areas. Some victims say that as the country waits for its legislative body to be formed in the wake of the protests, the general sense of community in the country has increased.
The political change that occurred had resulted in social change. We've seen a more collaborative approach and an increase in younger volunteers as an alternative to our government. They have been opposing the regime, but they can fulfill the government's role in its absence. The youth have done great work in this phase of our history.
Floodwaters killed dozens and displaced hundreds of thousands in August. But as the new government solidifies and the rainy season comes to an end, residents are hopeful that the rebuilding process can begin. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Khartoum.
How does a farmer or former Italian stockbroker join forces with Palestinian refugees living in the poorest camp in Jordan to create an international luxury brand of scarves, tote bags, and home goods sold in the likes of London's fashionable Harrods? The refugee artisans also have their elegant embroidery displayed in the Hollywood film Mary Magdalene, starring Rooney Mara and Joaquin Phoenix. Dale Govlak traveled to the Gaza camp in Jerash, some 22 miles or 36 kilometers north of the Jordanian capital of Amman, to find out more.
With its rickety homes and shops dotting narrow alleyways, this impoverished Palestinian camp has hosted more than 29,000 registered refugees, mainly from the Gaza Strip, since 1968. It seems like the last place for an international business to start up. But that is exactly what happened as Roberta Ventura, a former stockbroker who founded and heads up Jordan, an organization of refugee craftswomen, explains.
About 5 years ago, I decided that I could no longer just stand and look at the situation in the refugee camps deteriorating without private sector involvement. So I decided to start a social enterprise active in the refugee camp of Jerash in Jordan, which has the mission of bringing thousands of refugees above the poverty line in a way which is driven by their talent and not by donations or aid. When I see refugees, I actually see a huge untapped potential. I see people like you and me who've had to leave their homes, and I see their individuality crushed by their status as refugees. To work with refugees was probably always my vocation. I believe my 20 years in finance has prepared me for the challenge of becoming an entrepreneur. Now I'm glad to have quit my former career a couple of years ago and to be dedicating all of my time to refugees.
Inside the SEP workshop, some 350 Palestinian women gather from time to time. Many work in their homes while others come into the workshop. The women are embroidering and assembling upmarket tote bags, cushions, beach towels, beach bags, and a range of accessories and lovely colors. As project manager Noel Arada explains, she points to some shelves that contain all the colors of thread the women use to embroider their products: light blue, navy, gray, orange, red, gold, and many more. A beautiful beige tote, she says, is embroidered in an Islamic geometric pattern in sunbursts of pink, yellow, and orange, while another captures the colors of the sea in light blue, navy, and tan. Noel Arade says about 150 pieces are completed per week, and she shows what she says is their latest treasure, a beautifully embroidered cashmere scarf. Noel's colleague, 37-year-old Asma Arade, first embroidered pieces and now handles quality control. She and the other women were born and reared in the camp and describe daily life there as tough. Asma Arade says growing up in the Gaza camp was difficult. All the houses had flimsy metal roofs, and the schools contained asbestos, now banned. Winter rains poured in on their heads. One time a nasty rainstorm flooded her neighbor's home, so they ran over to hers for shelter. And there was only one dry spot where they all squeezed into that side of the room, she says. They were often covered in mud walking in the narrow streets. But things have improved somewhat. And it is because of this job, she says, that her family now really has a home, which is better constructed and safe. Asma says the women find that there are also other benefits to gain from embroidering. Most of the refugee women have practiced embroidery since they were young and continue to do so as adults, she says. SEP Jordan also provides 2 to 3 months of training to perfect their skills. Embroidery is relaxing, she says, adding that pressures are released when you make each stitch. It is stress release and helps to maintain focus. Asma Aradi says that you feel a release from tension, tiredness, financial pressures, and other things weighing you down psychologically and physically. One of the artists told her that she likes embroidering so much she has become addicted to it. She says the women put their feelings and emotions into the threads as they cross-stitch. That is why every stitch tells a story, which is also SEP Jordan's motto. The refugee women's fine work is being sold in Harrods, and also caught the eye of Academy Award-winning costume designer Jacqueline Duran, who commissioned SEP Jordan to embroider outfits used in the Hollywood film Mary Magdalene. Noel Arade gushes when speaking about this amazing venture. It was the ultimate happiness to see the actors wearing pieces the women worked on, she says. For the camp to reach Hollywood was a huge success and achievement. It's been something very beautiful. Most people don't even know that the Gaza camp exists in Jordan. Noel says she feels that SEP Jordan is introducing their camp to the world. And the women hope that SEP Jordan will keep growing, not just to reach customers and achieve sales, but so that they can give more women work who need jobs. SEP Jordan CEO Roberta Ventura says these women are committed to the project because they know the company is in for the long haul, unlike aid groups that have come and gone from the refugee camp. She says that helps the women to identify themselves with the brand as well. They do not feel they are beneficiaries of aid, but colleagues, she says, and that has an empowering impact. Dale Gaflack for VOA News, Gaza Camp, Jerash, Jordan.
And you are listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Villagers around Menganga, a town in northern Cameroon, are protesting against Chinese gold miners for allegedly ruining their land. The villagers say they are poorer than before the Chinese arrived, and their farms and forests are now destroyed. Moken Edwin Kinzeka reports from Menganga.
These are cattle ranchers and farmers from villages around the northern Cameroon town of Menganga. Their song says that if nothing is done to save them from Chinese miners, famine may strike their locality in a not too distant future. Their spokesperson is 54-year-old cattle rancher Mamoudou Poro.
C'est chinois qui nous fondue.
He says the miners destroy farms and do not even care to cover holes and trenches they dig on roads and cattle ranches before leaving. He says they want the Chinese to build the roads they destroyed and fill the trenches they dug, give them electricity and at least a school and a market before leaving. Until 2014, Menganga and surrounding villages cultivated maize, beans, groundnuts, and producing cattle for markets in Cameroon, Nigeria, and the Central African Republic. Then, some 300 new mining sites producing gold, zinc, nickel, and other materials were discovered in the region. Among the explorers were Chinese companies. More than 100 of the company's miners work in and around Menganga. They use caterpillar tractors and equipment that clean stones and sift soil, allowing them to detect gold faster than locals who use manual tools. Locals are paid about $2 per day to work at the Chinese mining sites. Cameroon's Minister of Mines, Gabriel Dododoke, says the complaints of the villagers are legitimate. He says he has asked the companies to respect the terms of their contract with the government.
Les populations riveraines n'en bénéficient pas encore tel qu'on pourrait attendre.
He says the population suffers as a result of environmental degradation and does not benefit as expected because their mineral resources are exploited in a disorganized manner. He says he has given instructions to all exploitation companies to make sure they respect environmental laws and stop destroying farms and cattle ranches, which for now are the only sources of living for the people of the area. Officials with the Chinese mining company in Menganga declined to be interviewed about the allegations. However, company official Hu Long said the firm has assisted communities by providing aid to hospitals and building or refurbishing schools when solicited. He says the company also employs about 100 youths. This is not the first time Cameroonian villagers have protested alleged exploitation by the Chinese. In 2016, residents of eastern Cameroon had conflicts with small-scale Chinese gold miners who had been there for 6 years. The local miners said the Chinese had taken away their livelihoods and were not living up to promises to develop the area. Cameroon has not officially announced how much it gains from the mining business, but says it contributes a significant amount to the country's GDP. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Meganga, Northern Cameroon.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
While the U.S. space agency NASA is on a mission to put a woman on the moon by 2024, and it's using star power to promote the effort and educate young people about space and all of the amazing work going on at the space agency, student interns working at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Texas have created a remix of Ariana Grande's song, God is a Woman. They shared their renamed and remixed version of, now called NASA, on Facebook and expressed their excitement about the future of space and all of the work being done by NASA.
We do is beneficial. We'll explore the universe because we're NASA. Out of this world, going to space, going to space, yeah, we're going to the moon.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at VOAnews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I am Lori London. Have a great day.
Bottom line, we got reputation for that space flight. Everybody knows we're working day and night. It ain't nothing wrong with saying we're in our prime with our eyes. Surely we will see another Earth rise. SLS will take our dreams beyond the skies. First stage will rise and shine through past horizon line. Yeah, failure's not an option or an issue. Mission is the goal that we commit to, and the science that we do is beneficial. We'll explore the universe because we're NASA. Out of this world, going to space, going to space, yeah, we're going to the moon, space, going to space.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Much of Iran's provocative activity, including proxy wars, sabotage of oil and other infrastructure in neighboring countries, even the recent seizure of oil tankers, was done by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC. The IRGC is a paramilitary institution that was established by the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini with an eye to eliminating internal dissent as well as external adversaries that might be perceived as a threat to the ideals of the 1979 revolution that gave rise to Iran's Islamic Republic. Working particularly through its Quds force, the IRGC is the chief Iranian institution directing and carrying out the regime's global terrorist campaign. As such, the IRGC was designated by the U.S. State Department as a foreign terrorist organization in 2019 and as a specially designated global terrorist by the U.S. Treasury Department. The IRGC trains, funds, and equips proxy organizations across the Middle East. Iran wants these groups to extend the borders of the regime's revolution and sow chaos and sectarian violence, said State Department's Special Representative for Iran and Senior Advisor to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Brian Hook. We are using every available diplomatic and economic tool to disrupt these operations. That is why the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $15 million for information leading to the disruption of the financial mechanisms of the IRGC and its branches, including the IRGC Quds Force. Anyone coming forward with information regarding oil for money or money transfer schemes, as well as tips on companies, financial institutions, or individuals that are owned by or do business with the IRGC, or are engaged in international activity on the IRGC's behalf, may be eligible for a reward. The Rewards for Justice program seeks credible and actionable information on how and where the IRGC raises and hides its funds and how it channels money to its clients. If anyone has such information, please contact the Rewards for Justice via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net, email info@rewardsforjustice.net or contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.